And I thought I would share something in terms of the importance of bioenergy that we are in right now, why plants need to help plants. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, just came up with its synthesis report a couple of days back, the final synthesis report for the fifth assessment. And as for that, the crops are going to be affected, we all know that, because of the climate change. And in majority of the low concentration scenarios that we are want to achieve by 2050 to 2100, it's essential that bioenergy crops are included as part of the mix in terms of achieving those CO2 concentrations. And bioenergy can play a critical role for mitigation of this climate change. These are some of the final findings that came out of the IPCC report that was just released. And on top of that, and if you want to maintain the climate at less than 2 degrees increase of global warming, bioenergy along with carbon capture and sequestration is a must in the mix, along with other renewable sources, nuclear energy, and then also fossil fuels with carbon capture and storage. And another thing is, even though bioenergy can play a role for mitigation, there are certain issues that we need to consider in terms of the sustainability of the practices and the efficiency of the bioenergy systems. I think some of the funding opportunities that are coming up through the Bioenergy Technology Office and also through the Department of Energy would address some of those issues in the long-term sustainability of bioenergy. And finally, the direct options in agriculture, forest, and land use involve reducing CO2 emissions by deforestation, avoiding forest degradation and forest fires, storing carbon in terrestrial systems, and also finally providing bioenergy feedstocks. So I've been following IPCC now since my master's days. That's when the first assessment came out in 1992. And this is the first time I have seen a very vocal support for bioenergy as part of the mitigation strategy for climate change. So I think there's a huge potential for bioenergy to play in terms of mitigation. At the same time, probably next assessment, bioenergy would also play a role in the adaptation strategies. As farmers and producers try to adapt to climate change where grain production would be affected, there's a potential that some of the income can be produced by having these bioenergy crops in the mix. So I think this is a pretty good statement for the future of bioenergy, and we'll look forward to the talks today and see what we can gain from that in terms of how we can manage these systems sustainably. And I leave the bioenergy crop production program there. I presented these slides earlier when you were all not here at 8 o'clock, so probably we might see them again during the business hour. So the title of my talk is Sustainable Bioenergy Feedstock Production in the Southern Great Plains. And I would like to thank my co-authors here. Most of them are grad students. Pradeep Wagle, he graduated last year, is a postdoc at the University of Oklahoma. And then Foster, he is a research agronomist at the University of Missouri. And Kundan Dakal, he is my current PhD student here in the audience. And the PI on this project, Dr. Ray Hanke, and Tyson Auctioner worked on the soil water as part of this project. And Jason Warren, he worked on the soil carbon dynamics. And so most of us know, like, why do we need bioenergy when you're producing enough petroleum fuels, right? So as you see this chart, the latest chart from EIA, it's projected to increase continuously. And at the same time, the U.S. imports of crude oil, that's what we all are aiming for in terms of using bioenergy for. There's a decrease in the amount of crude oil that's imported, and this is mainly attributed to increased crude oil and natural gas liquid production in the United States, reduced petroleum oil consumption through increased energy efficiency or improvements in that, increased use of biofuels that's now contributing about 10% of the total energy mix, and also renewable power through wind and solar. And also some of this is attributed to the weak economy, where we don't want to travel much, right? So our drive. But in spite of all of that, as we keep pumping more out of the ground, we keep on increasing the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, one of the major greenhouse gases. And if you look at these observations, we have crossed what we call as so far as the tipping point for the climate change. We have reached 400 ppm. We were talking about that long back, that we should not be reaching 400 ppm. We have crossed that, and we are right now around 402 to 403 ppm of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So that's going to pose challenges that we need to address through bioenergy. And I'm a fan of this. As I grew up in India, I used to watch The Cosmos by Carl Sagan at the time. And I even watched The Cosmos again. That was by one of his students, Neil Tyson, that was recently on, I think, what was the channel? Either NBC or ABC. But the striking thing that I observed in both of theirs is, this is the one of the California coast here. This is when Carl Sagan took that video, and this is when Neil Tyson did his video. So you can see the stark difference in the landscape, the green to brown, on the same California coast that caught my eye when I was watching these videos. So I thought I would show that up here. So why? Because this is one of his famous quotes, like, imagine a room awash with gasoline, and one has 9,000 matches and the other has 7,000 matches, and both of them are arguing that who is stronger and who is going to win. This was the comment was made in the missile or the nuclear arsenal race between the United States and Russia, but it also can be applied to the use of fossil fuels, because we are finding we are digging more. So where do we end up with that? And there's increase in affluence across the globe, and China has taken over the United States in the number of cars that are purchased per year. And I don't think India would be far behind in terms of the number of cars that we'll be seeing in the near future. So all these issues, major problem for in terms of the climate change. So in terms of the coming back to our topic here, the biofuel production, we are almost here now in terms of around close to 14.8 billion gallons of ethanol that's being produced. And the good thing is this year we have about 3 cellulosic ethanol plants that are coming online or have come online, 2 of them in Iowa and 1 in Kansas across the border in from Oklahoma. And once they show the commercial viability of these technologies that they are using, I think we'll be on the way to achieving these cellulosic ethanol requirements or the mandates. But one of the negative sides of that is, if you look at this slide here, the energy content of the motor gasoline oil is decreasing because of the increase in the addition of ethanol, either as an oxygenate or as through the mandates. So there's about a 3% decrease in the energy content of the gasoline that we are using today compared to the unblended gasoline. So that's a challenge for in terms of the conversion people to come up with drop-in fuels with the same energy content as that of the gasoline. So to make it on par with that of the gasoline, if you are concerned with that, but you can buy ethanol at a cheaper price and then fill more of ethanol. So that's how you look at it in terms of either you want to improve the energy content of the gasoline or you want to fill in more and then use the same fuel that we can easily produce. So as part of that, coming to my topic here, this is part of a larger birdie project that we conducted over 4 years from 2010 to 2014 in Oklahoma. And we have several objectives listed here, but I'll be concentrating mostly on the four in dark here, the development of best management practices. Again, looking at the enhanced diversity and productivity of these bioenergy production systems, then estimate the carbon sequestration and climate change mitigation potential of these energy crops, and then model the spatial variability of these important aspects of bioenergy production. These are the different sites that we had in Oklahoma all day in the Panhandle, Goodwell, where the rainfall is about 15 inches, but 2011 no rainfall, 2012 it was about 7 inches of rainfall. So these are the extreme climates that we have been working with in terms of establishing or proving how viable this bioenergy production is in this varied climate in Oklahoma. Coming to Woodward, that's around 20 inches of annual rainfall. Stillwater, Chickasha, around 30 to 35 inches. You come southeast to Lane, that's about 40 to 45 inches of annual rainfall. So that gives a good climatic variability in terms of looking at the potential for feedstock production in this region. So as I said, not only the annual, but there's a lot of year-to-year variability and in-season variability in terms of how we receive this rainfall. So as we go across these sites, there's a lot of variability in terms of the amount of rainfall and its distribution over time during the growing seasons. We might have a 10-inch rainfall event, so that's becoming more common with the climate change we have. So you plant sorghum, you have a 10-inch rainfall event, and then that's going to delay your sorghum by almost about 3 to 4 weeks. You lose the productivity potential of the sorghum because it's under submerged or waterlogged conditions where its growth is very much inhibited. So, and again, at Lane here, about 9 to 10-inch rainfall events, that would impact the growth and productivity potential of these crops. So when we talk about these production systems, we cannot forget about the climate variability that we would be experiencing as part of the ongoing climate change and variability that we are seeing. Coming to some of the results here, one of the initial things in terms of managing these crops, the perennial crops, especially switchgrass and mixed grasses, is weed control. As you can see here, this is when it is about 2 to 3 weeks after planting, and this is after a month. So that was our first target to address, how do we manage this crop and then have it established successfully. So we did that. How? Because we were using sorghum as one of the crops, and sorghum, you use concept-treated seeds and then apply a mix of atrazine and dual, you get a pretty clean field. So we tried the same thing with switchgrass. We worked with one of the Bayer guys out in Oklahoma to develop a titration methodology for the switchgrass seeds. So we were able to treat these switchgrass seeds with Concept and then apply dual on top of it, and we had a pretty good weed control. So we tried different rates and treatments of Concept on switchgrass, and we were successful in having this because that was our initial criteria to have these crops established across the entire region. So if you have this weed problem, it would be very difficult for us to establish. So we were able to achieve this by treating the seeds with Concept and then getting good weed control at the time of establishment. So what did this finally result in? These are some of the final yields over 4 years, 2010, 11, 12, and 13, across the different sites, Chickasha, Goodwell, Lane, Stillwater, and Woodward. There's a lot of bars up here, but this is the mixed grasses. It's a mixture of Indian Big Blue and switchgrass. So that's 50% switch, 25% Indian, and 25% Big Blue. And as you can see, because these are perennials, the yield increases over time. So right now it's the fourth to fifth year, and they're about to reach the plateau in terms of their biomass production. So you can also see the variability across the sites. For example, mixed grasses in Chicoche, they were about 6 to 7 megagrams per hectare, whereas at Goodwill, this is one of the sites where we had to irrigate because it's in the panhandle. That's around 5 to 6 inches in the years of 2011 and 2012. So to keep the experiment going, we had to irrigate the crop there. So we provided about 7 to 10 inches of irrigation in the panhandle site for these crops. And again, you also face these tough soils where it's very hard to establish. You try year after year putting the seed, you're only wasting the seed, but not establishing the crop. So there are some issues in terms of site selection for bioenergy crop production. And some of the sites, like for example Stillwater and Woodward, they've been doing pretty good in terms of about 10 to 12 megagrams per hectare from these mixed grasses. One of the things you need to consider here is the years of 11 and 12, they were extremely dry and hot in Oklahoma. So the months of July, August, and September, there was no rainfall. So but still the crop survived, especially the mixed grasses and switchgrass. And the same story here with switchgrass, yielding a little bit higher than the mixed grasses, up to 15 to 16 megagrams per hectare at the end of the fourth year. And coming to sorghum, that's again a different story there in terms of the total amount of biomass that you can produce. For example, in some of the sites with good rainfall and irrigation or solar radiation, you can produce almost up to 35 megagrams per hectare. So I think you can beat that. So there's ongoing research to further improve that up to 60 megagrams per hectare. Hopefully we'll reach there. So, and again, if you look at most of the sites, there's a potential to harvest about 20 to 25 megagrams dry tons per hectare. But in some of the sites, for example, Woodward, you can see that sorghum failed in multiple years, whereas the perennial grasses survived and produced yield when you have the rains returning to that location. So that's one of the important components we need to consider when you're trying to decide which feedstock goes where in terms of the long-term sustainability of these feedstock production. Yeah. And as I said, we were also looking at different mixtures of these feedstocks. So we were trying out either monoculture of Switch Indian and Big Blue or different mixtures of these three grasses and trying to see what would be the yield potential. Probably this is an outlier here because the plots were irrigated. So almost about 16 to 18 megagrams with about 8 to 10 inches of irrigation at that particular site. So when it's critically needed, if you can provide the minimum amount of irrigation, even for these perennial feedstocks, you can significantly improve their biomass production. But these other sites where it was only rain-fed, the yields are anywhere from 5 to 10 megagrams per hectare, depending on the rainfall, temperature, and some of the issues we had, even pest issues, like the 2011 and 12, the locusts or the grasshoppers would chop the stems at the bottom because it was too dry, and that's the only source for sugars in the grasses. Okay. And as part of the study, we also looked at the effect of nitrogen because our objective was to optimize the nitrogen for these different feedstocks. And around 80 to 100 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen, or about 75 to 80 pounds of nitrogen proved to be optimum at several of these sites. But looking at the Woodward site here, it needed a little bit higher nitrogen. Probably that's due to the dryness that we had at the site in terms of the amount of nitrogen that's available. So we had that showed a little bit higher optimum for that particular site. And in terms of the composition, we didn't see significant differences across sites and across years at several of these locations. I'm just showing here two, the Stillwater and Woodward locations. So the total nitrogen, hemicellulose, cellulose, and lignin concentration. So they're pretty much stable because it's more of a genetic trait rather than an environmental control trait. So that's one of the good things, that you can have a stable feedstock quality. I think So we also did some environmental assessments in terms of the net ecosystem exchange. We looked at the total amount of carbon uptake. So here, sorghum shows that it's around 300 grams of carbon per meter square compared to about 475 grams of carbon from switchgrass. And we use these results to model the response to temperature and other variables so that we can identify regions that have these maximum carbon sequestration potential. And we plotted these across years to see where the carbon uptake would be. As I said, 2011 was the driest year, and under those conditions, you cannot sequester any carbon because we are unable to harvest any biomass. But if you have good years, for example, 2008, where you have plenty of rainfall, almost you can grow switchgrass anywhere and then have biomass yields at the same time sequester significant amount of carbon. At the same time, we also looked at, from these eddy flux measurements, the evapotranspiration. The only difference between these two feedstocks that we studied, switchgrass and sorghum, is in their duration and in their growth patterns. Other than that, both of them being C4 crops, their water use, or the ET, and also the water use efficiencies are almost similar when you look at the over the entire growing season of the two crops. The switchgrass that greens in April or mid-March all the way to October, and then sorghum from early June to end of October. So both of these crops almost behave similarly in terms of their water use and ecosystem water use efficiency. I'll skip a couple of those. Just to conclude, so that I keep myself in time, the bioenergy production management, it can be optimized for realizing production potential of dedicated feedstocks like switchgrass and biomass sorghum. And also, the production is dependent on climate extremes that we're observing these days. And there are similar sink strengths for CO2 and similar in their water use efficiencies, except for the pattern in which the water is used. If you're concerned about the water moving into the streams and maintaining water in the streams, that's one of the issues you would need to consider, which feedstock to plant. And the potential impact of this study would be on regional to global level understanding of carbon sequestration, combining these eddy flux towers with the weather data that's available out there. Thank you. I think we have a break now for 15 minutes, and if you have any questions, yeah. Yeah, no problem.
I was wondering which cultivars of sorghum you use, and the question I asked is, because when I have in rainy season photosensitive sorghum, with some of them successfully grew at least 14 feet tall, and they have the same
Yeah, because these are some of the lines that we obtained through Ceres. That's one of their ES5200 line, energy sorghum, and it has got some. One of the things in the sorghums is when you want to harvest, your equipment should go through the field. If you have those thick stalks, as you were talking about, it'll be very hard for the machinery to go through without losses in terms of failure of the equipment. Yeah. But there is potential to improve on this, like, yeah, in terms of optimizing the population, and you can plan more per unit area and then improve the yield at the same time. Yeah. Emily. Yeah.
Okay, so can you talk about how you think that those should be deployed given that you have 10 of the drains at some time, and you know which grass is using water in the spring?
So the water I was talking about is the amount of water that's used and transpired by the crop. So in terms of the 10-inch rainfall event, some of them would occur just before planting. And one more thing is we haven't measured these at all the sites. So that I need to make that distinction in terms of where we measure these eddyflux. They were made at Chickasha site. Whereas at Lane, you have seen events that were like 9 to 10 inches during the growing season. So if we had these eddyflux measurements at that site, then it would be a different case. But when the site where we did these measurements, we had those 10-inch events just before planting, not during the planting time. So that would have made a huge difference.
I'll hope for a 10-inch rain event this year, and I think it would be
fantastic. Yeah.
You showed a lot greater net ecosystem exchange or more negative in the switchgrass than the sorghum. So the extra carbon in the, is that in the switchgrass below ground? Do you have root measurements?
Yeah, we do have root measurements, and in terms of switchgrass, it's almost 50-50 ratio, the root to shoot. So it's 1:1 in terms of, if you're growing about 10 tons above ground, it's almost 10 tons below ground. So we do have I'm sorry?
What is it for sorghum then, Rob?
The sorghum, I think, we have seen it's about
70-30.
Yeah.
That would be shaped to root.
Yeah.